What can we learn from animals? Say, for example, a pig named Christopher Hogwood.
One of the many things that he taught me, he was just a great big Buddha master, a genius at knowing how to love life, even when life gives you slops.
That's Cy Montgomery, acclaimed author of Soul of an Octopus. We'll talk with her about her wonderful new book, How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. Then we'll talk with journalist and author Earl Swift about his soulful and timely portrait of a 200-year-old crabbing community in the middle of Chesapeake Bay. It's facing extinction from rising sea levels. The book is called Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. There are a lot of how-to books out there on how to be a better person. But forget about the spiritual tomes and the lifestyle gurus. Maybe our greatest teachers are the animals we share our homes and planet with. That's what science journalist Cy Montgomery has found over a lifetime of friendships with fellow non-human creatures. Like Octavia the Octopus, she so movingly wrote about in Soul of an Octopus, a book for which she won the National Book Award. Her latest book, How to Be a Good Creature, reflects on the personalities and quirks of 13 animals and the truths revealed by their lives. They include a pig, a chicken, an ermine, a spider, and 3 emus, among others. Featuring charming illustrations by Rebecca Green, How to Be a Good Creature is a stunning and life-affirming memoir that explores such questions as how we learn to love and develop empathy, how we cope with loss and despair, and how we express gratitude and forgiveness in the world. How to Be a Good Creature is for readers from age 8 through 88 and older, and I can't think of a better book to read this holiday season. Cy Montgomery, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
I am thrilled to be here again.
So I love this book, How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. 13 animals?
Yeah, 13 individual animals, not 13 species. And each one of them gave me personally a different gift exactly when I needed it.
Yeah, the emphasis is really on the life lessons that you have learned from animals. Why that focus?
I was interviewed by a dear friend. This is Vicki Croak, whose most recent book was Elephant Company, a national bestseller. Wonderful, wonderful book. Anyway, she came to the house and talked to me about all the different places that I've been in my career of writing about animals. And then, gosh, I guess it's like 27 books I've now written about animals, and at the end of the interview asked me, well, you know, you've written about natural history, and you've spoken about these animals' great powers to navigate this world with senses that we don't have, but what have animals taught you about your life? And my answer was, how to be a good creature. And this was archived online, and one of my editors happened to see it and called up and said, you have to write this book. And so I kind of balked at writing a memoir. I wrote another memoir called The Good, Good Pig, which was a memoir of my life with Christopher Hogwood, this wonderful pig who lived for 14 years teaching me and everyone in Hancock and beyond about comfort and joy until he died in his sleep of old age. And it's hard, though, to write a memoir, and particularly this memoir, because there's some wonderful things to share in it, but there's also some darkness in it. Everyone's life has darkness. But that was all the more reason that I wanted to write the book for readers who may have shared this kind of darkness, and to remind them that teachers are everywhere all around us. And sometimes they might have a flexible nose disc and a curly tail. You know, sometimes they might have 8 legs or 8 arms. That sometimes meeting an animal for just a matter of minutes can transform your life and help you see something important. And all of these animals showed me stuff about things that my readers would face too. You know, how to find your destiny and know what it is, and then how to set off on the path to that destiny, how to make a family, you know, which doesn't necessarily mean you have to marry an opposite sex person and then make a bunch of babies. There's many ways to have a family, and that's something Christopher Hogwood taught me. It's made out of love. It's not made out of blood. And how to face difficulty and danger and sorrow and loss, and how to fall in love with the world day after day after day. And that's what these animals have taught me.
Oh, that's so beautiful. You know, and before we kind of go back to your childhood, where you do pretty much start the book, tell us about Christopher Hogwood. I mean, and you and your husband have both written books about this pig.
That's right. That's right. And Howard wrote a book called Christopher Hogwood Steps Out, which is a wonderful book for kids about how Christopher would always let himself out of his pen, because he's very smart and he liked company, and just go visiting people. And in my book, too, I write about how Christopher Hogwood's the one who introduced me, a shy person, to my neighbors. He would let himself out of his pen. Everything we tried would not keep him in the pen when he wanted. And we even had a very nice area that that he had shade, he had sun, he had mud, he had grass, he had everything a pig would want except company. And when he got lonely, he would get out of his harness, he would get out of his pen, and he'd go visiting. And by the time I got a phone call from a neighbor that he was in their yard, he had already charmed them, and I all of a sudden had a new friend. So he was just great in teaching me how to make friends with people. I'd never had trouble making friends with animals, but making friends with people, that was a whole other thing. And that's one of the things that Chris taught me, one of the many things that he taught me. He was just a great big Buddha master, a genius at knowing how to love life, even when life gives you slops. In fact, especially when life gives you slops.
Exactly. Now, we should mention that your husband is Howard Mansfield, who has been a guest on Writer's Voice and will be again because he has a new book out that we're going to talk to him about. But so talking about, you know, going back to how you as a child could relate far more easily to animals than kids, your mother always said to you that you were never a normal child.
That's right.
Talk about that.
Well, I guess normal children are attracted to other children. And there's a number of reasons, I guess, that other children were not my friends when I was little. One, and I go into this kind of briefly, is when I was around two, something happened to me, and I probably had some brain damage from my aunt told me that my mother had shaken or smothered me because I cried during the cocktail hour, and that was very upsetting. So, but here's the great thing. I apparently got over much of the brain damage, and because I wasn't doing well, I was failing to thrive as a child. My parents tried everything and finally came up with the idea of adding a Scottish Terrier puppy to our family, and that took care of the problem. From then on, I was a joyous little being, and I had a wonderful friend. I wanted to be when I was very small, I wanted to be a horse, and my mother was concerned, took me to the pediatrician, who said I would outgrow that phase, and I certainly did when I announced that now I was a dog.
You wanted to be a horse. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I mean, who wouldn't want to be a horse?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, goodness sakes. So, but then I wanted to be a dog. And my existential problem as a little kid was that everyone wanted to teach me how to be a little girl, but this did not interest me. I wanted someone to teach me how to be a dog. And when Molly came along, that's exactly what happened. And she showed me, I mean, not only did she essentially save my life, causing me to once again want to walk and eat and play, but she also taught me to be a great observer. And to be a good observer, you need to be quiet. You need to not wiggle. You need to not try to scare the animals, because it's interesting to see the pigeons fly away and watch the squirrels run. And a lot of little kids just delight in making animals fly or do whatever they want to do. Kids, though, I think, do naturally want to watch animals as well. And I was free to indulge this with Molly, who was a fabulous observer of natural history, because a Scottish Terrier wants to know, where are the squirrels? Where are the birds? Where are the people? What are they doing? And I became her apprentice. And I grew up to do what I always dreamed of doing with her, which was to run away to the woods and observe the hidden lives of animals. That's what I do for a living.
Yes, and what a wonderful thing to do for a living, not only for you, but for the rest of us who get to read about it. And in fact, after college, you became a science and environmental journalist for a local paper in your town, but really found your métier in the Australian outback with three emus who inspired an epiphany in you. So tell us that story.
I had a chance to go to Australia, thanks to my father's generosity, buying me a ticket on vacation. And I joined an organization called Earthwatch that pairs paying laymen with scientists around the world doing research. And I had gone to preserve the Blanchetown Conservation Park in South Australia, a preserve for the endangered southern hairy-nosed wombat. And during the 2 weeks of this vacation that I was working, the principal investigator, Dr. Pamela Parker, who ever will be a saint in my book, said to me, "I can see you love what you're doing, and I wish I could hire you to be an assistant or give you a ticket so you could come back, but I can't." But she said, "If you ever wanted to come study Australian animals, you could live at my research community, which was a bunch of tents in the park, and I would give you food." So I quit my job and moved to a tent in the outback, not knowing what I would study, but kind of casting myself at the mercy of the universe. And these three emus showed up one day right in front of me while I was working on a project helping another researcher. And I realized, this is what I could study. Because even though the emu, this tall, flightless bird who can run 40 miles an hour over the outback and sever fencing wire with a single kick with their very strong legs, even though they're flightless, that's not a disability for them at all. Even though they stand beside the kangaroo on Australia's coat of arms, no one really knew what they did all day. No one had really done even a pilot study, spending as much time as possible seeing what they do. And that's what I did. And the epiphany that came was, one, that I wanted to do this for the rest of my life. And two, that the science of observing what they're doing and writing it down and then crunching the numbers and all of this was very important, but just as important to me as a writer, and I think also to many scientists, was that I fell in love with these animals and that my relationship with them was a key to understanding who they were as discrete individuals, that their individuality mattered, and that my relationship with them was an important tool of inquiry. And this has informed every single book that I have ever written.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, it reminds me very much of Jane Goodall's approach as well, that, you know, instead of the dominance of behaviorism, which I think probably lumped animals all together, it is in understanding their individuality that we also understand our connection to them.
absolutely right you are, as frequently, in fact, always the case, is my observation. But yeah, Jane Goodall's work was my model. And the first book that I ever wrote was an homage to her and her two scientific sisters, Diane Fossey and Birute Galdikas. And I wrote not a triple biography, but essentially a triple biography of their relationships with their study animals.
Right. Oh, that's wonderful. Now, let me ask you a little bit about being a science journalist. You know, when I first heard about you, it was about your book, Soul of an Octopus, and I just assumed you were a scientist and then learned that you were a science journalist. Could you talk a little bit about choosing the path of journalism versus the path of becoming a scientist?
Yes, actually, this is something that occurred to me as a very young child when I began to read. Because up until that point, until I began to read, I always thought I would grow up to be a veterinarian. And that is still a wonderful use of a life. And, you know, I deeply admire veterinarians for their work. But when I began to read, my father would share with me stories in the newspaper that were about animals. And I'm 60 years old, so I'm learning to read in the 1960s. And the New York Times, my father's favorite newspaper, was full of stories about animals because of the problems they were facing at human hands. Because the 1960s was when we began to read about pollution, mm-hmm. about human overpopulation, about deforestation, about overhunting. And the idea that some of the animals that I loved could become extinct, like the dinosaurs, even animals like whales, even our national symbol, the bald eagle. This horrified me as a child, and I saw the importance of the journalists who were writing about these problems, and I saw the power that writing could have, and that's when I chose that path.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Cy Montgomery about her new book, How to Be a Good Creature, A Memoir in 13 Animals. You know, you talked before about some of the darkness, and I think we can, you know, from what you've already said here, some of that had to do with your mother. In New Hampshire, where you live, you got a lesson about your mother from an ermine. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing that right. Ermine?
Ermine. Yeah, ermine.
An ermine. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that fierce creature and how it taught you the lesson, what that lesson was.
This was amazing. My mother had died a few months earlier, and it was Christmas Day. And Christmas Day, I always bring our chickens a big brimming bowl of hot popcorn, which they love. So, and I love my chickens. I have to tell you, I know them all individually from the point that they arrive at the house when they're 2 days old and still shaped like eggs. They grow up in my office. We love each other very much. Okay, so I go out to give my chickens their Christmas breakfast, and one of my hens is dead on the floor, and her head is kind of wedged in the corner. So I go to pick her up to try to find out what happened. And I can't pick her up. Something's got a hold of her head. So I pull and I pull. I get the chicken free. And a head pops out of this little hole in the corner of the coop. And it's an ermine. And an ermine, as you know, is the white-coated winter version of the weasel here in the north. They don't change to white in the south, but they do in the north for camouflage, and they're beautiful. They are pure white. White is an angel's raiment, you know, and they have these coal black eyes and these little pink noses, and this one had a little smear of blood on its chin. And with these piercing eyes, it looks at me, a monster who weighs 120 pounds and towers 5 feet, 5 inches tall. This little thing weighs as much as a handful of coins and is looking at me savagely. Give me back my chicken. Well, of course, I thought it was my chicken. But the animal, its ferocity blew me away. It was like all the wildness of every, like, tiger and lion and wolverine was just folded into one little creature just a few inches long. And I was dazzled, and I felt absolutely no animosity towards that animal, despite the fact that it had just killed someone I loved. And in that moment, I realized that my mother shared a lot of the characteristics that I so admired and was in awe of in the presence of that little ermine. My mother was also fierce, and she used her ferocity to get what she wanted. And what she wanted growing up poor in rural Arkansas as a woman, she wanted to go to college, which she did. She was valedictorian of her class. She learned to fly a plane. She got a job at the FBI and then married herself a bird colonel who later became general. And this poor girl growing up in Arkansas ended up traveling the world with people who would carve meats at her parties. And her husband had a staff car and a yacht and a helicopter. And she got to wear furs and have incredible parties. And she got the life she wanted. And it was a struggle as impressive as a little tiny mammal bringing down a giant hen. And so in that moment, I realized how much I admired my mother and how much I owed her. Because my dad, as an Army general, he was also a World War II hero. He had survived the Bataan Death March. He had survived years of prison in Japan. I always admired him and thought that I got my toughness from him. But I realized I also got that from her. And I grew up knowing that if it could be done by a person, it could be done by me. And I owed her for that. And I realized in that moment how much I admired her and how much I loved her and how much I missed her.
That must have been very healing because it was quite tough to be her daughter.
Well, I wouldn't have picked any other parents. I'm happy with how my life has turned out. It's a great life. But you know, she disapproved of a lot of things I did, including marrying the love of my life. Howard is not only the best writer I have ever read or known, he is the best editor I have ever had. And he is, I mean, God, marrying him was the best thing I ever did in my entire life. And my parents disowned me for marrying him. So, yes, my mother, and my mother was the one behind that. As it turned out, she didn't like it that he was Jewish, but she didn't know it. But she'd married a Jew also. After my father died, I learned that he was Jewish and had never told my mother. He had hidden it all his life.
Wow, that's remarkable. So let's talk about moving from the ermine to the tarantula.
yes.
Clarabelle the tarantula. That chapter seems to be about fear.
Well, I was never really afraid of spiders. I mean, I knew that if a spider bit you and it was like a really venomous spider, that was no good. But the biggest fear that I encountered with Clarabelle, this beautiful, darling pink-toed tarantula, wild tarantula, who I met living in a bromeliad. She was living in the bromeliad, not me, in French Guiana. My biggest fear was that somehow she would be hurt and it would be my fault. Because the first time I held her, I was thrilled to be holding her. It was just like holding a little furry animal because they are about, you know, it's kind of like holding a little chipmunk, except one with
eight legs
and kind of more eyes than a chipmunk. But, and they're skeletons on the outside, not the inside, and they can taste with their feet. Well, I guess it's not all that much like holding a chipmunk, but it kind of is because it's a furry little animal in your hand. But the wave of tenderness I felt to this spider quite surprised me. And when she began to kind of speed up, at first she was walking from one outstretched palm to the other, like a little turtle when you hold a turtle in your hand and you just kind of pass your hand one after another, and the turtle keeps walking. Well, she was starting to go really fast, and I thought, oh no, she's going to launch, because they do jump. And I was afraid she would jump and land on the hard substrate, which we were on a little patio, and I was afraid that she would hurt herself. And that's when I began to shake with fear, because, oh my God, to have her hurt and have it be my fault, it would be horrible. And, you know, just like we can break our bones, their skeleton's on the outside, and they can break part of their skeleton from a bad fall. And if you have super glue, sometimes you can help that to set, because they will eventually grow a new exoskeleton. They shed their exoskeleton. But meanwhile, they need their exoskeleton to walk around and hunt and escape from predators and stuff. So, and we didn't have any super glue at the time. We could have rushed out and gotten some, I suppose. But anyway, doing first aid on a tarantula was not my forte. And I didn't want any harm to come to her.
So, but certainly tarantulas are something that we do fear. And, you know, fear is much on the mind these days, as it seems to drive so much violence. We're talking today, just a couple of days after 11 people were killed in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. I wonder if you could talk about the connection between how we treat animals and how we treat our fellow humans. In other words, how we treat our fellow creatures and how we treat our fellow humans, and what fear has to do with that.
Well, obviously, the horrible murder that had just happened was because of fear. Fear that turned to hate. And it's been shown that when we have more connections with others who are unlike us, that it expands our compassion. Now, it's my hope that if you have a friend who's a dog and a friend who's an octopus and a friend who's a spider and a friend who's an ermine, that will expand your heart enough that you can have a friend who's different from you and a human, that should be a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have a friend who's a different religion. You can have a friend who's a different race. You can have a friend who has different beliefs from yours, but whose beliefs you can still respect. And to me, animals and the natural world are a direct connection to God, because it's the Creator's work all around us. And it's my hope that animals can inspire us to be better creatures just by reminding us how beautiful this world is in all of its difference. And if, like me, you've had a friend who's like an octopus, mm-hmm. who can taste with all of their skin and change color and shape and squeeze their boneless body through a tiny crack in a coral, well, then you've really expanded your world and you've expanded your capacity for compassion.
Right. I mean, octopuses are so different from us, and yet many think that they are as intelligent as us. And I don't even think, you know, even the idea of intelligence, it's not even a thing of which are as intelligent as us or less intelligent as us. As you've talked about in your other books, I mean, even a fish has an intelligence, and even in this book you call them, you talk about superpowers. It's not a quantitative difference, it's a qualitative sameness, consciousness.
Right. And as you point out, you know, our measures of intelligence, we've begun to expand our measures of intelligence, even of fellow humans. There's emotional intelligence, which is extremely important in forming bonds with other people and other animals. I mean, actually, what could be more important than that? And that kind of intelligence wasn't even identified or recognized or honored until very recently. So when we talk about other creatures' powers, an octopus could look at me and say, okay, how many different colors can your severed arm turn in under 1 second? None? You're a pathetic idiot.
Which is how we think of animals. Oh, they can't speak or read books.
Right.
They're pathetic.
And even when they do speak, we ignore it. Some of them will speak in what we're now understanding is a real language. Prairie dogs, for example, can describe, oh, there's a man with a red shirt and a gun. Really? That has now been shown. Yep. Chickens, it's now been shown, can make up a name for their owner.
Wow.
And I know someone who has a recording of the name that was made up for her. We even have parrots who will speak to us in English meaningfully.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Irene Pepperberg, for example, and her Alex and those African gray parrots who followed in Alex's footsteps. And yet we don't see it. I mean, there's so much around us that we haven't learned to see. So we need to apprentice ourselves to animals, observe their superpowers in order to expand our own powers and see the real world for how rich and complex it truly is, but that we can't apprehend with our senses. We need all kinds of other senses, and we need all kinds of other minds, not just animal minds, but also different human minds. My friend Temple Grandin, for example, has severe autism, which used to be looked at as a horrible disability. But there's a flip side to that. And because, not despite of her autism, she's been able to see many things from animals' perspectives and create a more humane environment for animals who are used for food.
Now, finally, you talk a lot about your dog, Tess. Tell us about the lesson about grace that she taught you.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my Tess. She was about the most graceful, athletic animal that I'd ever known, despite the fact that she'd had a leg injury long before we met. And she could fly through the air and catch a frisbee no matter where you threw it, and she could even do it in the dark. Well, I always was amazed by her grace. She lived a long time. We had her 14 years. We got her when she was just 2. And when she got old, she lost her sight and she lost her hearing. So no more could she soar into the air to catch the frisbee. In fact, at night, when we went outside for her last call, she had to stay right next to me. But she handed that grace right back to me. The grace that she showed that was so athletic when she was young was transformed into the kind of grace that let me repay her by leading her through the dark in her old age. And that was an incredible gift to me.
That's so beautiful. And Cy Montgomery, it has, as always, been a privilege to talk with you about this wonderful book, How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. It's been just wonderful to talk with you here.
It's wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Cy Montgomery is the author of 20 books for adults and kids, including Soul of an Octopus and The Good Good Pig, her memoir of life with her pig, Christopher Hogwood. Read an excerpt from How to Be a Good Creature at writersvoice.net. Next up, the story of one of the most isolated and endangered places in America. We talk with Earl Swift about his book, Chesapeake Requiem. Stay tuned.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do I? All I need is my brother. I say I'm gonna get high.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The recently released National Climate Assessment estimates that climate change will slash the U.S. economy by 10% by century's end unless we get serious now about reining it in. One place that's already experiencing the existential threat of climate change is Tangier Island, Virginia. It's a unique community on the American landscape. First mapped in 1608 and settled during the American Revolution, this tiny sliver of mud is home to 470 hardy people who live an isolated existence centered around fishing for the prized Chesapeake Bay blue crab. But Tangier Island is disappearing. Its shoreline retreats by 15 feet a year due to rising sea levels, and the pace is picking up. Scientists say islanders could be forced to leave their home within 25 years. Journalist Earl Swift had been reporting on Tangier Island already for over a decade when he decided to live there for a year and report in depth on what's happening to the community, a community that's very much a canary in the coal mine for coastal communities everywhere. His book, Chesapeake Requiem, is an intimate look at the island's past, present, and tenuous future. Earl Swift is the author of 7 books and hundreds of major features for newspapers and magazines. He lives and works in Virginia. Earl Swift, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you so much, Francesca.
Chesapeake Requiem, this was really a wonderful story, a story about a year that you spent in Tangier Island, a year with the watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island is the subtitle. First of all, situate us a little bit. Tell us about Tangier Island.
It is a tiny speck of mud and marsh in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay at the widest part of the bay. The estuary is about 30 miles shore to shore at that spot. And this little, very low-lying, essentially treeless piece of turf in the middle of all that water is 12 miles from the nearest mainland port, home to 460 people, most all of whom can trace their lineage to the first settlers who arrived in 1778. And it's among the most isolated towns in the East, if not the lower 48. Although it's only 90 miles from Washington, D.C., it is marooned from the rest of America, disconnected from the road system. There's no way to get a car to or from Tangier except to hire a barge and to take it over. There's a passenger mail boat that comes over once a day, year-round. That's the only year-round boat, and it comes out of Crisfield, Maryland. So if you're a Virginian and you want to get to this little Virginia town, you have to actually leave your state to do it. You have to drive into Maryland and take the ferry over from there. It earns its living harvesting the bounty of the bay, mostly the Chesapeake Bay blue crab and oysters in the wintertime. And that's been the case for 200 years, that the island's men have gone out in little boats to harvest those fisheries.
Right. And you said people first settled there in the mid-1700s. Tell us a little bit about, who they were, how they came. I mean, it's a very, I wouldn't say maybe unique culture, but maybe unique for us now. In many ways, it's a culture that's a kind of a cultural throwback.
In some ways it is. It's a near theocracy of old school Christians, Methodists mostly. The first settlers moved there to raise livestock. It's pretty cheap to keep cattle in a place like Tangier because you don't have to pay for fences. The bay does your corralling for you, and so they moved there to raise cattle and sheep and procreated. And before long, the population, by the time of the Civil War, the population was well into the many hundreds, and there was a big influx of outsiders during the war because Tangier was kind of neutral ground. It did not secede from the Union with the rest of the South. It aligned itself with Northern Methodism, and so it became this fugitive piece of Yankee territory in the middle of Virginia, and that made it a kind of a safe harbor, and so a lot of people came there during the war. And it's got its own style of speech, which is a product of its isolation, and which harks back to kind of the Cornish settlers who made up a lot of the early people on the island. It's the accent's a mixture of the hoitoid kind of tidewater accent that you hear throughout the mid-Atlantic and this Irish sea kind of lilt. And it can be completely indecipherable to a newcomer to the island. Until you tune your ear to it, you have a hard time making out words, because Tangiermen tend to take a single syllable word and stretch it like taffy and then knot it into two or three syllables and adjust the pronunciation of each in unexpected and creative ways. And to complicate matters further, they often say exactly the opposite of what they mean. So if you are lucky enough to pick two words out of 10, say, that are being spoken, odds are you'll get the meaning wrong just the same.
This wasn't the first time you went to Tanger Island. You went there in the late 90s and in 2000, but the year you spent there spanned 2016 to 2017. What changes did you see when you returned at that time?
It's hard to miss the fact that there's a lot less island than there was in 2000 or in the late 90s. I mean, the erosive effects of sea level rise have had a profound impact on the place. It's a much soupier, much more watery place than it was back then. And this is an island. It's a marsh island. So it doesn't have hard edges. It's difficult to measure sea level rise coming up, you know, a fixed coastline. There's no such coastline there. What you see instead, although the island certainly has gotten smaller around its edges, what I think is the most dramatic change is that the interior of the island has gone from upland to marsh, and those portions that were marsh have started to turn to mudflat and open water. And so you see the whole thing just disintegrating. It's dissolving, essentially. And that was apparent within minutes of my return. I could see evidence that that was happening. It was just a very different place from the way it had been. The other big change was that there was another form of erosion afoot, and that was that the population was in free fall. And when I was there in 2000, there were 604 islanders. When I returned, there were about 470. So it's, to lose essentially 20% of the population in 15, 16 years does not bode well.
And is there a connection between the two events, between the sea level rise and the loss of population?
Oh, I think without question there is. One feeds the other. The sea level rise has discouraged any newcomers from buying property on the island. I mean, how do you sell a house on a sinking, shrinking island? It's tough to do. And so fresh blood has not been arriving in abundance. And, the island's physical dilemma further discourages young people from staying, who were already, truth be told, leaving the island in droves as far back as the early 80s. But even so, those kids who might want to stay and make a go of it on Tangier find the prospects pretty daunting, given the fact that scientists say their island has 25 years or less to be around.
Wow. Now, you point out in the book, Earl Swift, that there are even figures that show loss of land going back to 1850. The people themselves don't seem to believe largely in global warming or sea level rise. They call this erosion. So talk about the differing impacts of how, quote, erosion, unquote, has been happening. Has it been happening for a really long time? And then I'm going to, ask you more about the relationship that people have to this idea.
Well, it's true that hundreds of islands have disappeared in the Chesapeake Bay since John Smith mapped the place in 1608. What you see, though, from the bulk of the academic literature on land loss in the Chesapeake and sea level rise seems to indicate that began to accelerate greatly in the mid-19th century. Right around 1850, something started to happen that had not been happening before. There was a point of inflection there in the chart. If you were to chart land loss and sea level rise, the rate of sea level rise 1850 is where it starts to happen, where that line in the chart starts to nose upward. And throughout the late 19th century, it accelerated, and then in the 20th began to gallop. And now that we're in the 21st, is proceeding at a rate unforeseen by scientists just 10, 15 years ago. Of course, in the late 19th century, scientists did not have the tools at their disposal to recognize that what was going on in their bay was related to a global phenomenon. What they saw was erosion. What they saw was land, islands washing away, and so they were. But to view erosion and sea level rise as mutually exclusive phenomena is a mistake. These are interlinked. The higher and the faster sea levels rise, the more destructive the power of wind-driven waves. And so really, you know, when islanders point to other islands, once inhabited, once vibrant, that were abandoned in the early 20th century, places like Holland Island, Maryland, Jane's Island, Maryland, Sharp's Island, Maryland, places that had towns and hotels and churches, schools, you know, big harbors filled with boats, and that are now completely vanished, you know, they tend to see that as evidence that, well, that can't be sea level rise because, look, it happened back in 1880, 1890. Well, it was already afoot then. It wasn't moving at the speed it does now. But this is not something that just popped up in the last 20 years. This has been going on for a while. It just took us a while to see it.
And you point out in the book, Chesapeake Requiem, Earl Swift, you point out that there is kind of a double whammy going on here. Not only is sea level rising, but the land itself is subsiding. And
yes.
So explain this phenomena to us.
Well, this is a byproduct of the last ice age, which ended 12,000 years ago. At the height of the last ice age, you had an ice sheet that covered most of North America. Well, it covered all of Canada and the northern tier of what we now recognize as the United States. And it was so thick, 2 miles thick at its thickest, and so heavy that up in subarctic Quebec, its weight pressed down on the Earth's crust and compressed the mantle underneath. Now, the mantle is what the bulk of the planet's made out of. It's that layer of the Earth that comprises the bulk of the Earth. And parts of it are viscoelastic, meaning they're gel-like, they're goopy. And when compressed, they behave as a gel is prone to do, which is they squirt away from the point, you know, that goopy material squirts away from the point of compression. And in the case of the Laurentide ice sheet, that pushed mantle, that displaced mantle from up in the subarctic southward. And wherever it went, it forced the crust above it to rise up, to bulge. And you have a huge bulge that developed at the leading edge of this ice sheet, which is just south of New York and extending down through the mid-Atlantic to about the north, let's say the Outer Banks, Cape Hatteras. Well, then the ice melted. And as it did, that weight was lifted off of the subarctic and the ground there began to rebound. And all the mantle that had been displaced by that tremendous weight began to ooze its way back northward to go back home. And so this bulge that had lifted up the mid-Atlantic began to subside, and that process has been going on for thousands of years, and it will continue to go on for thousands more. And around Tangier, it amounts to about a 16th of an inch a year, which doesn't sound like much, but you pair that with sea level rise, and holy smokes, it's a real problem on an island that has no elevation to give up. I mean, this is a place where the highest point of the island, well, most of the island, you know, is 3 feet above the tides or lower. It's a very low-lying place.
Has there been any impact of warming waters on crab populations in the Chesapeake Bay yet?
No appreciable effect at this point that I've been made privy to. Now, that will change if places like Tangier wash away. If we were to lose that and were to become just a shoal, you'd lose the protection that it affords seagrasses. Right now, it acts as a windbreak for seagrasses, and crabs and a lot of other marine life need those seagrasses on the bottom of the bay to survive, for mating, for hiding, any number of things go on in the grasses that are essential to the crabs. And without the windbreaks, you know, you've got a much more turbulent environment for that seagrass to try to endure, and the prospects for it are a lot bleaker. So you lose islands, you lose habitat, not only on the island itself, but offshore. So although you can't point to any one thing associated with sea level rises as affecting the bay's fisheries yet, we're at the cusp of something happening that certainly will.
You talk about someone named Asbury Pruitt, who has been chronicling the shrinking of the island by putting out posts on land that then go underwater over time. And you say that this was a turning point. Why was it a turning point? And, you know, has it kind of brought people to become more aware of what's actually going on?
Well, I think so. Now, Asbury died a good dozen years ago. But he was he worked for the Navy. He was a Tangierman. He got a job as a spotter because the Navy used to have a couple of target ships a couple of miles west of Tangier out in the bay. And jets from Oceana Naval Air Station in Virginia Beach and from Patuxent River and from elsewhere would come in and do bombing runs on these derelict ships that were parked out there. And spotters on the shore in Tangier would radio to the crews of the planes as to how close they had come with their smoke bombs, etc. Anyway, as this job gave Asbury a fixed point of reference from which to watch the coast. Now, Tangiermen, you know, they were very familiar with their coast. They were in boats every day. But when you're in a boat, you're not in a fixed point of reference. And what Asbury was able to see was, you know, on windy days with winds from the west, huge chunks of the island were breaking off on the west side, and they were getting carried off. And so he decided that he would take an iron pipe and jam it into the marsh and then measure the distance from that iron pipe to the surf zone. And then he would go back every year on that day, January 8th, and he'd remeasure it. And what he found the first year shocked him. I mean, where the erosion was proceeding the slowest on the west side of the island was getting 12 feet narrower. Where it was proceeding quickest, it was close to 20 feet. And year after year, as he kept these measurements, the situation grew more dire. Pretty soon, the annual loss was 30 feet of shoreline. And it became quite clear that there was, you know, an emergency underway on Tangier. There was this memorable state report that came out in the mid-70s that pointed out that Tangier had a whole bunch of problems that had to be addressed eventually. But if that problem wasn't fixed, then nobody need worry about any of the others. So, yeah, I mean, until Asbury Pruitt came along and did that, Tangiermen had a vague sense that their island wasn't as big as it had been in their grandfather's days, say. But they did not have evidence. You know, they didn't have hard data to glean just how much they were losing and at what speed. And really, Asbury Pruitt, his measurements are what prompted the government to get involved in into looking at trying to slow down the effects of what at the time, back in the 60s, was viewed as just erosion.
Yeah, I mean, the Army Corps of Engineers built a channel, which actually made things worse. Now people talk about a seawall. You know, it's been talked about for a very, very long time. You know, Trump has a huge amount of support there. He also denies global warming. He actually came out to visit the island. Do you think he's going to build a wall?
Well, he has not visited the island. He telephoned the mayor of the island. Now, I mean, Tangiermen hopefully look to the skies for Marine One to this day, ever since that phone call. But, you know, this is not a simple process. There are some measures that could slow the progress of sea level rise, or especially the wind-driven wave action from the west, that would cost in the tens of millions of dollars. And that would buy the island some time. A lasting fix, which the Corps, the Army Corps of Engineers, has unveiled as, to call it a plan or a proposal even is giving it too much credence. It's a concept at this stage. Yeah, that could buy the island a century, but it would come at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking, we're closing in on $1 billion for the price tag for that project. So, you know, do I think he'll do it? Well, it's not up to him. This would have to get through the Army, for one thing. The Corps of Engineers has a process, and then it would have to get through Congress. And that's a tough sell. You know, when you're talking about a population of 460 that's dropping, and you're talking about spending $800 or $900 million, we're talking $2 million a head. And as the Corps itself points out, it would probably be a lot more attractive to Congress to just build every man, woman, and child on the island a $200,000 house in the mainland and, spend a dime on the dollar. It's a tough sell.
You ask a number of questions on page 31 of the book, Chesapeake Requiem. You say, what makes a community worth saving? Will its size prompt the nation to fight for its survival, or are other less tangible factors just as important? What is important to us? Now, this is something we really think about. I mean, are they going to just build walls around places like New York, or are they going to abandon New York, or are places like Tangier Island, or for that matter, the community that I live in East Hampton, New York, going to be valuable enough? As you finished the book, what was your thought on those questions? How did you answer them for yourself?
Well, I guess for myself, I think that if headcount cannot be the sole criterion that we use to decide what place is worth saving and what we surrender to the sea, there are going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of communities in peril, just like Tangier is now, in the very near future, in the coming very few decades. And we don't seem to have really gotten off the dime much in deciding how we're going to decide what we're going to do about it, because we will not have the time, the money, or the means to save all of them. And we're going to have to come up with a rubric for making those tough choices. You know, if population is the sole criterion, then we automatically surrender a lot of places that Americans hold dear for various reasons, historical, cultural, whatever. You know, it will not be easy to let go of. Do we give away the Everglades? Do we give away Jamestown and Yorktown and other places that are basically sacred ground in the story of America? Do we value the unique places like Tangier, or are they less valuable because they do not reflect the American mainstream? You know, what rubric do we use? And I hope it's going to take far smarter people than me, Francesca, to come up with the answer to that. I don't know, but it does worry me that we're not talking about it.
And your book is a wonderful way to get into the asking of those questions, very important questions, really critical ones. Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Earl Swift, thank you so much for this conversation about this very important issue.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Earl Swift is the author of 7 books and hundreds of major features for newspapers and magazines. You can read an excerpt from Chesapeake Requiem by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.